On this week's 51%, domestic violence from two angles. First, we'll hear about a message from a book about domestic violence, an adult message from a book written by a girl.
Think twice before possibly harming your kids.
Then a retired police officer discusses a protocol adopted in his New York County to help victims. Plus, hiring women mechanics to appeal to women. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
Cover up with makeup in the mirror. Tell yourself it's never gonna happen again. You'll cry alone on that. He swears he loves you. Do you feel like a man when you push her around? Do you feel better now as she falls to the ground?
Each year, hundreds of thousands of children in the U.S. are the victims of domestic abuse. Some die at the hands of the people who are supposed to protect them. That's what happened to Maxwell. He was 2 when he died after a history of neglect and abuse that was never adequately addressed. He left behind a family who will never forget him, and a sister who has worked to cope with his passing. Rachel Otwell brings us the story from Jacksonville, Illinois.
My family had a good life, at least most of the time. Mama, me, and Maxwell, and our dad, who we saw sometimes.
Valerie Iyer has thick, long brown hair and big, soulful brown eyes. The 11-year-old has a polite, soft-spoken, yet confident demeanor. She's teary as she reads from the book titled, Why Did We Have to Say Goodbye? It's the first time she's read it all the way through out loud. It's made more difficult by her tendency to stutter. Her adoptive parents, Gwen and Glenn, watch on. They're crying, too.
Her dad was loud and sometimes rough. He did not want to play. Mama said, be nice to him. Don't make him go away. I think that Max was scared sometimes, and sometimes I was too.
This book is about a tragic event. Valerie's brother Maxwell died from an injury he sustained from his biological father. Valerie was only 4 when it happened. Gwen explains.
One night, he was there on a visit, and the dad pushed him very hard. Never was it really clear. It appears that there was some anger involved. He pushed him hard enough to cause an injury similar to shaken baby syndrome.
Johnny Garcia is now serving a 44-year prison sentence at a correctional center in Illinois for his crime. Gwen says it's not known whether Valerie was also physically hurt.
To my knowledge, she's never said that she witnessed, that she was there even. We don't know that she was even there that night. We haven't gotten all the information about it, and I don't know that we ever will.
Gwen and Glenn started adopting children in the mid-80s. They have 5 in all. Gwen's involvement with foster care and adoption ultimately led her to work with the Department of Children and Family Services, where she currently is a foster parent law compliance manager. One of Gwen's adopted children is Valerie's biological mother. She says after Valerie and Maxwell were born, she was worried something like this could happen. It was clear her daughter, their mom, did not have a stable lifestyle, that the violence baby Maxwell was victim to was not a well-kept secret.
There was some risk that we'd identified. The dad had been in trouble legally, and mom had been hospitalized for injuries, but I think so often when women get involved in domestic violence situations, they can't get out. They don't see a way to leave. She kept going back, and even at this point, she was not living with the birth father. There was a repeated history of abuse, we think. We often encouraged her to take Max to the doctor. She did many times, and as a result, the doctor did lose her license for not reporting. You know, we hold the mother really accountable, but to me, the doctor should be held accountable. She only lost her license for a year, but she did lose her license, and in theory at least, has been trained and better equipped to identify the next time. But the department evidently asked her, were the kids at risk? And she said she had not identified any risk as a doctor. So many different steps, you know, so many people trying to do the right thing, and yet none of us could really help him.
Since the book was published, Valerie has been busy signing copies and talking to the media. The project started as a life book, something used as part of therapy for children, especially those who have been adopted or are in foster care. It is meant to help them retain connections and map out their past. Gwen helped gather pictures for Valerie, including those of her biological father and brother. Gwen says in order to be therapeutic, the book needed to be realistic, to include the good and the bad. And while all this has gotten Valerie much attention for a traumatic experience in her past, it's not the only thing that defines the young girl.
I'm 11.
You're 11? What school do you go to?
Illinois School for the Deaf.
All right. And where do you live?
Jacksonville, Illinois.
And what kind of things do you like to do?
I like to play an instrument called the mountain dulcimer. I like to ride horses. And I like to read books.
Valerie takes a moment to play her dulcimer at the bed and breakfast where she lives. She jokes about it being out of tune, something she can still notice even though she is partially deaf. Her hearing aids are a help.
You should hear it when it is in tune.
Yeah, sound a little different?
Yeah.
Valerie has Usher syndrome, a leading cause of deaf blindness, but this too has yet to keep her down. Valerie tells me someday she'd like to run a bed and breakfast herself.
Kids need meeting all kinds of interesting and new people. We even had a guest from Germany. She stayed for about a month.
Valerie, her mom, and I head downtown where Valerie has regular meetings with a counselor. Meg Lorton comes and greets us in the waiting room of the counseling center. She's wearing neutral color clothing. Her shoulder-length blonde hair is down. She takes us back to her office, a cozy room meant to be made comfortable with a couch and a homey feel. Lorton says when she first went through the book Valerie and her mom put together, she knew she wanted a copy for other patients. She thinks Valerie's story comes with an important message for those affected by domestic violence.
You are not alone. Others have survived and went on to be very happy, satisfied with life again. Those feelings at that moment when you're going through it, you feel like there's a loss of hope.
Lorton says not just any child in this situation would be so willing to share their story.
This was not something that happened overnight. This has been a process since the initial experience. I think it's so valuable for her to be able to even want to share this, even to sit here in an interview process and say, okay, I'm opening up myself to help others.
I ask Gwen who she credits with Valerie's ability to face the challenges that have come her way, things that would leave many depressed and bitter. How can a young child have decided she wants to help others by sharing a story that brings her such pain?
We have that faith, I think, that protects us, but also supports us. It's a sad, sad story. It's an awful story. The hope is very important to us that we are Christians, that we've accepted the Lord as our Savior, and that we will be reunited in heaven one day, and we have that hope.
It's the hope that life can get better, that being a victim of domestic violence does not have to define an individual or a family, but a reminder, too, that it's always okay to remember and to honor the lives of those who have been lost. For Valerie, that includes sharing her story in order to prevent future atrocities.
There's two different messages, one for kids and one for adults.
Okay, you want to tell me about the one for kids first?
That message would be when you see someone hurting someone small, you should go for help.
And then what's the message for adults?
Think twice before possibly harming your kids. I just hope no one else will have to go through this again.
For 51%, I'm Rachel Otwell.
And now you'll hear about what is being done to stem domestic violence from the perspective of a retired police officer who is currently a county legislator. Just more than an hour and a half north of New York City sits a county that has taken on a program to help identify domestic violence victims and offer them help. The county is Dutchess, and the program is the Lethality Assessment Program, or LAP. The Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence created LAP in 2005, and jurisdictions across the U.S. have been adopting it, Dutchess County included. LAP provides an easy and effective method for law enforcement and victim service providers to identify victims of domestic violence who are at the highest potential for being seriously injured or killed by their intimate partners and immediately connect them to a domestic violence service provider. Retired police officer and Dutchess County Legislature Chairman Rob Rollison talks about how the program is helping, but starts where the problem escalated.
So what we saw here in the county several years ago, we had a series of domestic violence homicides, more than normal, over a period of a year or two. We're talking about 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people who were killed at the hands of their partners or their significant others. And we looked at these individual homicides and what could have been done to, say, prevent them. And unfortunately, not everything is doable to prevent them. You know, if people want to do harm to one another, they're going to find a way to do it. But there were things that kind of, you know, jumped out at the individuals within our domestic violence system here, and we'd call it high-risk case conferencing, and we did, reviews of how each person became a victim of domestic violence and what ultimately may have led to their death. And there were some similarities in the types of behavior that the offender had shown.
Like what?
Well, you know, where you look at things that they did to you before you may have called the police, the types of violence that they may have perpetrated against you in your home or where you worked, you know, stalking, violence against animals, threats against children, a real controlling atmosphere that sometimes offenders can use to control their victims and keep them right where they want them.
He says after local law enforcement and local organizations worked harder to identify offenders and offer services to domestic violence victims, he and others in the county became aware of LAP.
So the Maryland protocol is, it's actually fairly simple in that we want our first responders, police officers, to ask a series of questions at the scene of a domestic violence incident. And based on the answers that they're given, these lethality assessment, LAP it's called, these LAP forms are analyzed by professionals, and they will fall into different categories. The victims will fall into different categories. And if it is determined high risk, there is an immediate response of not only just law enforcement, I'm talking about a response not to the scene of a potential crime, but to that person and her circumstances, and advising them, getting them in to have a conference on their situation. Because many times, just because you call the police maybe once doesn't mean that you have not been involved in an ongoing series of domestic violence issues for years. And many times that's what you find out, that, you know, sometimes it takes a while for someone to make that phone call to 911 to get something started. And what we believe is so critical in this area is that once you get it started, we're going to get it started, and we're going to help you as much as you want.
Wait, so back up to the initial questions that the police are asking the victim.
Were you ever threatened with a weapon, or was a weapon actually used against you? As we talked about a little bit earlier, you know, has the offender threatened to kill your children? Do you think, as the victim, that this person might kill you or use violence against you? Do they have a gun? If they don't, Or if they do, where is it? And if they don't, could they actually get one? You're starting to dig a little bit deeper into the relationship and the background of the offender. One of the things that an extreme example of violence is choking. You know, have you ever been choked by your offender? And strangulation, up until a few years ago, wasn't really in the domestic violence world as far as the law was concerned. And now strangulation, or 3 or 4 years ago, maybe longer, is actually now something that is used. When someone does that, the crime is elevated, and also the risk is elevated, and people respond to that risk in these conversations. The controlling atmosphere, you know, what kind of control does that person try to exert over you? Unemployment, has the person ever tried to kill themselves? Because many times, if someone is at the end of their rope, what they do prior to maybe taking their own life, they're not so concerned about. So what you've seen in many murder-suicides, spying on you, stalking, leaving threatening messages where, I'm going to get you. I'm coming back. And so what we found, and what they found in Maryland, and I'm glad that they actually looked at these cases, many of these things were linked to further violence and ultimately a homicide involving that person.
So after this list of questions, the police officer or police officers, whomever, comes back and presents this to whom?
This goes right to the district attorney's office. We have people who work within the DA's office and also work for Family Services, which is a nonprofit agency which helps with staffing in these areas along with DA staff. And they look at these reports, and they then, you know, immediately try to intervene. You know, when I came on the job, really in 1979, and I was working part-time when I was going to college, and then I became a full-time police officer in 1982, we didn't do any of this. We would get, and it wasn't even called domestic violence, it was called family dispute. You know, you would go to these calls in these homes and other places, and you did the best you could, but there really wasn't a aggressive or proactive stance. It was, you know, you go there and you go over there, and I don't want you to fight anymore tonight. And in some respects, you just prayed that you got throughout the shift without having to go back. You know, there really, I wasn't aware of shelters. There may not even really been active shelters at that time or advocates. This really started in, you know, the mid-80s and then really accelerated from the late 80s into the 90s and now today. But what you saw as more people were becoming aware of family violence and, you know, now today's domestic violence. But when you look at what has happened over the years, there are now mandatory arrest procedures where even if the victim doesn't want to sign a complaint and you as a police officer believe a crime has been committed, it is incumbent upon you in certain circumstances to make that arrest, whether the victim wants to really cooperate or not. And that is done a lot because it's relieved the victim of the pressure. And then she can follow up, and then she can say, yeah, God, he's out of the house now, and we can now talk about this.
So let's jump back to LAP.
Let's go back to LAP.
So we filled in.
We filled in the gap.
Family dispute.
Right. Now we're really innovative. So now, right. I think this really is a great tool for individual police officers to use at the scene of an incident, because many times, you know, that cop may respond to that house maybe once. And the next time it may be somebody else, or in many jurisdictions, it could be a different agency where you have multiple jurisdictions covering one area, whether it's a sheriff's office, a state police, or a small local agency. We want to make sure that everybody's on the same page.
But are you seeing it act preventatively for the reoffending?
Yes. Absolutely.
Isn't that the point?
Absolutely, because if you look at what we went through with these DV homicides, we are not seeing them at the level that we did. We are seeing less violence per se in the area of reoffending, because we've identified some of these individuals and we are keeping them away from their victim. And also, too, you know, we just don't say to an offender, okay, well, you know, you've been identified as high risk and, you know, we're going to lock you up and throw away the key, because we can't. So they also try to work within the judicial system to let these people understand, look, whether you believe it or not, you are showing signs, you know, documented, proven best practices that you could reoffend. And you could reoffend in a way that you may do serious harm to that individual and to your family. You may not have a grudge against your kids. You may have a grudge against your wife or your girlfriend. And if you do something additionally, you may never see your children again. You know, so there's, you know, I think there's something to be said about also saying to this offender, if they want to listen, or at least to their lawyers, they are falling into a high-risk profile here and you need to know about it.
That was Rob Rollison, a county legislator and retired police officer, talking about his county's use of the Lethality Assessment Program, or LAP, to identify domestic violence victims. Switch gears. Car mechanics tend to be male, but one Paris area garage is trying to change that by hiring women to appeal to women. Sarah Elzis met two female car mechanics at Only Girls.
Aurore Dabriot is a slight woman. Her hair is tied up in a bun. She doesn't look like somebody who might be talking about manual work.
En grandissant, je préférais métier de manuel.
Growing up, I knew I wanted to do a manual job, not sit inside at a desk all day, she says, taking a drag on a cigarette. She studied car mechanics in high school, was the only girl in her class. She remembers harassment from classmates.
Pourquoi je fais ça? J'ai rien à faire là.
Why are you here, they'd say. You don't belong here. Her teachers supported her, but she still had trouble finding a job afterwards. Male mechanics would question her ability to do the work. When they see how small I am, they say there's no way I can do the job, she says. Every time she'd apply for something, she'd get an excuse. We don't have changing rooms for women. We don't take apprentices. It's discouraging and disappointing, she says. Eventually, she dropped the idea of becoming a car mechanic. And that could have been the end of her story, but it wasn't. Today, Aurore manages a team of four mechanics in a garage northwest of Paris. She's here because Laïd Dachi came across her CV at the employment office.
Dans le domaine de l'automobile, il y a peu de femmes.
There are very few women in the world of cars, says Dachi. But here at his garage, the goal is to have only women. It's called Only Girls. Women can bring their cars here to be checked out by women.
Malheureusement, les femmes ne connaissent pas tellement mécanique.
Women, unfortunately, don't know much about mechanics, he says. Neither do many men. Some garages take advantage of this ignorance, adding on work to raise the bill. Everyone has the feeling of being cheated by a mechanic, says Dachi. And since there are only men, women feel they're being cheated by men. Amel Beraou goes out of her way not to bring in her own car.
I'm asking my dad or brother to go with my car.
She says she's made to feel stupid.
Even if I ask them what's going on in my car, they say, yeah, it's nothing. Like, I can't understand because I'm a woman.
Beraou works with Dachi in the office. They set up Only Girls at the start of 2014 to draw in female customers with female mechanics.
A woman can feel more comfortable to ask a woman mechanic what's going on because she's feeling like, oh, it's okay. This woman mechanic doesn't treat her like a stupid woman, someone who doesn't know about the mechanic world.
And trust is the point here. The mechanics are encouraged to explain to clients what they're doing to their cars. Aurore here is replacing the steering mechanism on a small Audi. She's working with Melina, a 19-year-old who's the daughter and granddaughter of car mechanics. She loves cars.
Ça m'a toujours attiré comment les voitures fonctionnent.
Cars have always attracted me, she says. How they work, how they run. Like Aurore, she studied mechanics but had trouble finding a job.
On nous dit souvent une femme ça a rien à faire dans un garage.
I was told a woman has no place in a garage, she says. Here, she has a place, and she likes the ambiance, explaining her work to customers.
Ça vient naturellement.
It comes naturally, she says. It's a pleasure to pass on what we know.
Voilà. Ça.
Melina and Aurore work with two male colleagues today. The goal is to get to an all-female team, but Amel Beraou says it's not easy to find candidates.
Because I think in France, a woman to work in the mechanic area is not in our mind.
But the ones who do work are dedicated.
It's a passion, because it's rare, and she loves that. And our customer can see that.
Est-ce que c'est cette clé?
You really have to push to say, I'm able to do this, says Aurore. It's not just because I'm a woman that I can't be here. She hopes that by offering the possibility of work, a garage like this one will encourage more women to enter the field.
Ça peut les encourager.
Knowing they could find work in a garage is encouraging, she says. And self-confidence is key. Putting forward your capabilities is what'll get you hired, she says.
Il faut avoir du caractère, savoir y aller.
You have to have the strength of character to go for it. For Radio France International, I'm Sarah Elzis in Saint-Ouen-Lomond.
And this was also produced by Sarah Elzis for Radio France International. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Katie Britton for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1335.